Welcome in to a new edition of the Locked On Knicks podcast. We are starting off talking All-Star Weekend, RJ Barrett's big game in the Rising Stars Challenge, and then the All-Star Game's new format. It worked.
And then we are going to get into some post-All-Star resolutions for the Knicks. Spoiler alert, two discussions about Mitchell Robinson and one discussion about a certain player that has been in Westchester for a large amount of time lately. And this is just going to be part one of two of our post-All-Star resolutions. So that's all coming up next on Locked On Knicks.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
This is all rebound, back up, off the glass, it's good! RJ Barrett brings the Knicks to the
rim! What he does is contagious.
Robinson with a catch and slam across the lane, Knox foul from behind, count it, and one to Trier. Trier drives down.
Becomes infectious. You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast. I'm Gavin Shaw. Across that wide body of water known as the Hudson, he's Alex Wolf. He just defeated his cat, and we're going to get into it talking All-Star Weekend, Alex. I thought the game itself was amazing, but we should probably keep it local and start off with RJ Barrett.
Yeah, he killed it in the Rising Stars Challenge. I'm going to be completely upfront. I didn't even pull up the stats. It's not that important.
He had like 27 and 6, I want to say. I don't have it either.
27 points. He had like, I think it was 6 assists and 5 rebounds, something like that. A very, very good stat line. RJ killed it, man. He was great. Kind of got robbed by the fact that his team like totally crapped the bed, but Team World was up for a while, and you would have thought they should have won. You know, I don't know, like going into it, I was like, oh, Team World has this locked up. Like they have way too much talent to lose. But, you know, then it starts turning into just a dunk fest, and that obviously favors Ja Morant, Zion Williamson, and those guys. So I think that's kind of just what happened in the end. But yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed watching RJ play. And, I met up with Schwinny on Saturday night to watch the dunk contest and all that. And it's funny. He's like, you know, it's really sad that, like the best, some of the best utilization of RJ that we've seen lately is in a, like, rookie All-Star game. And it was kind of true. Like, he was surrounded by players that could actually do stuff. And was given a role where he was handling the ball and all that, and it was phenomenal, and it was really fun to watch him play, and it seemed like he really had a great time too. Like, he was out there with Zion, and he seems to be buddies with Luka and all that, so maybe some connections he can leverage someday in the future to bring some of these guys to New York 8 years down the line or something.
Yeah, hopefully those connections go the right way. But it was awesome to. He deserves it. I almost I know this is gonna sound harsh to some people, but I almost look at it like he got like a week off from prison, and it's like, oh, you get to play with like in a fun game with no stakes that you win pretty easily with other super talented young players. And I just, and given like all the toxicity around the Knicks, especially, I mean, the last few weeks with everything that's gone down with the front office. I can just imagine that he really, really got a kick out of this and appreciated it, and good for him, because he's, I know I've had complaints about his play at time, but overall, I mean, very, very happy with him. And I think he deserved a respite. So I'm thrilled for RJ. Let's get into the, All-Star game itself a little bit, because I was thrilled. I think a lot of people over the years have disagreed with me on it, but I love the All-Star game, and the fourth quarter of All-Star games has really always been, like, outside of the finals, like, my favorite basketball all season, just because it really does give you a great gauge of who the 10 best players in the league are and what the pecking order is amongst them. And it's always, not always, but in the right years, it gets competitive in a very specific way where these guys just start going mano a mano, And it's beautiful to watch because it's the only setting where you get that and you realize, okay, who do these guys amongst each other actually think is the best? And you can tell that by who's getting the ball, who's taking the shots, who's on the floor. And this one was a little weird because Giannis did such a poor job drafting that I was of the opinion that a lot of the best guys or guys that should have been in the game were on Team LeBron's bench. And Ben Simmons, Luka Doncic, to a lesser degree, guys like Devin Booker and Jason Tatum, just in terms of guys I'd want on the floor offensively in those situations. But it was canceled out by the fact that the format of the game was so great with the Elam ending. And I just got such a kick out of it, Alex. I mean, even though it was kind of ugly, like this is as good as basketball gets in terms of talent.
No, it was really fun, and they seemed to care, particularly the third quarter, too. You know, the first two quarters, it seemed like they almost conceded, like, we're going to each give each other one quarter so yeah. that both the charities got some money. So, like, for those that didn't watch it, they did a thing where each quarter was scored individually, and, you know, all the, like, each quarter would give $100,000 to charity, and then the final quarter would give $200,000 to the charity of, you know, of the winner. And it wound up being $300,000 for the final quarter because the first two, they just swapped like huge quarters where they blew each other out. And I think Team Giannis went into halftime up by like almost 15 or something, yeah. which was kind of surprising, as you said, because it seemed like Team LeBron was going to blow them out of the water. But then ultimately down the stretch, you kind of saw like, okay, LeBron's team clearly had the better players that could clamp better on defense and like just wreck Giannis's team, quite frankly. Like they had better perimeter shooting, they had better all around games. I mean, you had like the closing lineup for LeBron's team was like Harden, LeBron, Kawhi, Anthony Davis, and who am I forgetting?
James Harden, Chris Paul.
Chris Paul. That was who I was forgetting. Yeah. I mean, that's like, forget about it. That's like, there was no way that Giannis's team was going to beat that. And they didn't. But, like, it was cool. My only real complaint, I mean, so, like I said, I thought that the first two quarters were kind of very all-star gamey, you know, where they were just trading dunks and stuff. But the third quarter, I mean, it really seemed like they wanted to win that third quarter and get that money for their charities. And you know, also just for pride's sake. And, you know, you saw, Team Giannis like actually pulling out all the stops just to even tie it to end the third quarter. So then that rolled the money over to the fourth quarter, and then to end the game, I mean, it was insane. Like in close all-star games in the past, like you said, like, you know, they do play hard if it's a close game down the stretch, but so many of them too, it's a blowout by the end. You know, one team just kind of pulls away in the third quarter or whatever, and you know, they try to play hard, and the one team will try to make a comeback, but then it all just kind of devolves into fun and games. And this one, because of that new rule where they just tacked on the 24 points to Team Giannis's score, and, you know, it was like play to win, and that's it. You know, you don't have to do it within the confines of time. Just play your hardest until, you know, one of you scores that amount of points. It was insane, the amount of competition level. It was way more than I'd ever seen in an all-star game. And I hope they keep this format now because it was very fun to see. And, like, yeah, just awesome. Like, rave reviews for me. My only complaint, Gavin, and we sort of talked about this a little bit before we started recording, is it ended on a free throw, which kind of sucked. It was interesting seeing, like, pretty hard fouls in an all-star game.
Yeah.
and, you know, they were actually fouling each other quite a bit down the stretch, but I think an improvement, and I'm sure that they'll learn from this because people were talking about it immediately after, like, oh, I can't believe the All-Star game, this like whole big ordeal just ended on a free throw. It should have been sort of predictable that that was going to happen because when it gets tight in late basketball games, particularly in that situation where it was a do or die proposition, of course they're going to foul him and put him on the line rather than, you know, let him attempt to make a clean jumper. But like, yeah, that part just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I feel like an easy solution to that is you just play almost like when you play 21, you know, the popular playground game, which is like you have to get to 21 points. In that case, it's get to it exactly to win, and you can't win on a free throw because free throws are part of that game. In this case, you could just be like, you don't have to hit it on the nose, but, you know, you have to win on a jumper of some sort. And you had said that someone had suggested, like, if there are free throws in a game-winning situation, then you could start deducting points off the other team. That's cool by me. That would be pretty cool, and that would extend the game for a little longer too, which would be really fun. But even if you don't do that, you know, you could instead just have it be like anytime you get fouled in a late game situation like that, you just get the ball on the sideline and you just have to, you know, take it outside and that's it. And earn your final shot and your final points. So I don't really care either way, one way or the other, but love the format. Just don't want it to end on a free throw again, just because I thought that was just kind of anticlimactic for like what was really a fantastic quarter of basketball to watch and something that I hope that they keep like forever now. All right, we're going to take our first break, but just a quick reminder, today's show is brought to you in part by Theragun. The stress of daily life weighs on us all. Whether you're an elite athlete or just a regular person trying to get through the day, muscle pain and muscle tension is a real thing. That's why I use Theragun, the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combination of depth, speed, and power. Fun story, actually. My brother-in-law got one for Christmas, a Theragun massager, and I went over to his house recently. I go to the gym enough that I experience some aches and pains from time to time, and I had something going on in my shoulder, like kind of near my shoulder blade. Couldn't identify. It was like a knot or something. It's bothering me for like over a week, and so I went to his house, and he goes, "Hey, I got this new thing. Like, do you want to try this Theragun?" And I go, "Sure." So he takes the thing and puts it, you know, right on the spot of my back and runs it for a minute. And I swear to you, I felt instantly better. And I am actually going to go over there again sometime soon, or maybe just buy one myself, because it was that good to finish dealing with that issue and hopefully use it after every single workout, because it is phenomenal. So you should feel better naturally, treat your pain, and get back to your life like I did. Try Theragun risk-free for 30 days or your money back by going to theragun.com/lockedon. For a limited time, our listeners get a free charging stand with purchase as well, a $79 value. So that's theragun.com/lockedon, theragun.com/lockedon.
Yeah, one of my best friends, Tyler Prime, shout out, he texted me, he's like, AD has to miss these intentionally, like, there's no way the game can end this way. And I was like, all right, well, like, you can't do that. And the other factor was, I think everyone was exhausted, like, that final quarter went on 42 minutes, and weirdly, it was like both coaches forgot that they could sub, and I guess it was just because of the situation that essentially, like, crunch time, like, final 2 minutes was extended over, like, 35 in terms of, like, when LeBron and all the starters for them came back on the court. But it just, again, my only complaint was, I wish, and I said this earlier, I wish Giannis could have drafted a little bit better. I mean, he took Siakam over Kawhi, he took Embiid over Kawhi, and then he took Siakam over Luka, which were both like you just, even if it's not Kawhi, if you just threw like Tatum and Luka on the other team instead of Siakam and Kemba, that ending is a lot more interesting, because they were literally just trying to post up whoever Harden was guarding, which turned into such BS basketball. I know Embiid made a few of them, but it was like Embiid trying to bully guys too, which was like a little like anachronistic. Like, it felt like we were back in the 80s a little bit, but overall, again, it was amazing just seeing. And it felt like you did sort of learn a lot about who the best guys genuinely were. The fact that Chris Paul is still kind of in that category. I know Russell Westbrook's been killing it the last few weeks, but it sort of reaffirms my idea that was a dumb trade. And LeBron and Giannis going back and forth was really interesting, how Giannis blocked LeBron twice in the fourth quarter. And then there was a possession where LeBron really got Giannis, and Giannis was sort of struggling to score down the stretch, which I think is kind of foreboding for the playoffs a little bit, and sort of indicative of the fact that even though he's been utterly amazing this year, like averaging something like a point per minute and probably going to set a PER record, I still think he has some of the same flaws in his game that held him back in the conference finals, where if he's not getting to the rim and you just kind of pack the lane, there's not so much that, I mean, he's still going to be a beast, but just in crunch time, the right type of defense, and maybe it's a team like the Sixers that just have so much size and length, can slow him down a little bit. And then the biggest one was I think it sort of reaffirms that Kawhi Leonard might be the best player in the world, or at least the best guy to have in a crunch situation in terms of his ability to just get a shot off. He's kind of Jordan-esque and Kobe-esque in his ability to just hit really tough mid-rangers. And I mean, there is something to be said for LeBron's brilliance. Like, he was the one who just sort of picked out that mismatch of 80 on Lowry on the last play and got that pass in there. So it's intriguing to see how all these guys stack up to each other. And then even someone like Kyle Lowry, and Bill Simmons made this point on his podcast, and I totally agreed with it, that like nominally he doesn't belong on the court talent wise, but he just got some kind of confidence boost from winning a championship. And all of a sudden, I mean, he wasn't great in terms of efficiency, but just balls to the walls and didn't look like that he didn't belong out there when just from a pure talent perspective, he probably doesn't really belong in that group. So those are all my individual takeaways. I just want to shout out the Elam ending in general. It started with, well, like a professor at Ball State, I think, is the guy who came up with it. Nick Elam, if I remember correctly. And the basketball tournament, which is, for people who don't know, a million-dollar winner-take-all single elimination summer tournament that features all the best players in the world that aren't in the NBA or in college. And I wonder if this is something the NBA would ever consider using in the playoffs or even in regular season games, because it is, I would say it's genuinely more compelling than like one team pulling away and teams just fouling down the stretch. And I don't think it's going to be a regular season thing just because it extends games maybe a little bit too much, unless you, obviously you can make the target score lower than plus 24. So I guess there's a scenario where it works there, but I think for the playoffs, like down the road, it's kind of interesting. I have a feeling they won't do it just because, I mean, most leagues don't really make dramatic changes to gameplay when they're so well established. But I kind of think it's a better way to play basketball.
Yeah, I could see it. I mean, I could see it in a weird idealistic world. It's just not going to happen because like the NBA is not going to make a sweeping change like that to something like the finals or something.
Yeah.
But it is cool. I mean, it was. I definitely think they should just do it for the All-Star game forever now, because that's the one place where you can kind of screw around. But also, there's still talk. You know, they tabled it, but there's still talk of this in-season tournament and stuff. So, you know, if they're going to do an in-season tournament or a tournament, you know, for the bottom teams to play into the playoffs or whatever, you know, there's all these talks about all these different ideas. Those are also places where you could potentially implement this. I don't think you're going to be able to implement it into the full-on 16-team regular, you know, playoffs once that starts. But, you know, it is definitely a cool idea for if they add one of these new wrinkles to the NBA season. And honestly, I think the idea of a midseason tournament is really cool. You know, whatever the prize would be for that. I think it's a really neat idea, and I hope that they continue looking into it, and if they can find like a really good viable way to do it, that they do it. But yeah, so definitely very cool. I do think, Gavin, that we could probably move on to our post All-Star resolutions though, unless you had anything else to add about the All-Star game.
No, let's get into it. I'll start off with one of mine. Mitchell Robinson, because I think this is the most important one. Shout out to Jonathan Macri in the Knicks Film School letter for compiling a bunch of stats on Mitchell Robinson that convinced me of something I already believed, that he should be playing 30 minutes a night. And I know the obvious qualifier is okay, but he has to stay out of foul trouble. And even though he's gotten better at that, it's still an issue this season. He's averaging about 5 fouls per 36 minutes. But there are also a lot of games where he's not in foul trouble, and Mike Miller's inexplicably playing him 20 minutes a night. And I don't have a good gauge for the reasoning on that. And I'd be interested, Alex, if maybe he's at some point he's given a good answer in a post-game press conference. But it doesn't make sense because nominally the idea behind playing the vets is because they give you a better chance to win. But the Knicks are significantly better on the court when Mitch is on the court relative to Gibson. Per Cleaning the Glass, the team's overall scoring margin goes up just over 6 points per 100 possessions when he's on the court, which is second out of everyone on the Knicks to Elfrid Payton. Also from the Knicks Film School letter, he's also one of only two Knicks to help them score at least 2 points per 100 possessions and give them, give up at least 2 points, score two more points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor and give up two less points per 100 possessions when he's out there. And it's indicative of, a lot of the subtle ways he's improved this season, whether it's in terms of setting picks or continuing to get better and better finishing around the basket. His effective field goal percentage is the highest of anyone in the NBA, playing at least 20 minutes per night. He's one of three players in the league with at least four combined blocks and steals per 36 minutes. And beyond that, it's a lot more joyful to watch Knicks basketball when Mitchell Robinson's on the court versus when he isn't. And I guess the core point of all these that we're going to do is just developing the young guys, and that should be the emphasis of that at this point, and I think that's obvious. But even if you want to go with what I would say is a somewhat misguided attempt to win games, and I do accept the idea that there are extenuating circumstances there, and it's hard from a psychological perspective to convince a team with a lot of vets on it that them playing is for the best when they're still clearly the better players. But that's why the Mitchell Robinson playing, just less minutes than he should under Miller is confusing, because it's not the case with him. And I don't understand what the counter argument is to it.
Yeah, I do think he, to your point, your goal was get him to 30 minutes a night. I think he's been playing, lately, as long as he can stay out of foul trouble, he's been playing about 25 to 30. But yeah, if you can, he has to play a minimum 30 minutes a game. And I don't see the reason anymore, other than establishing rhythm, I guess. That Mitch sometimes has a problem with getting his head on straight right at the beginning of the game, and that's sometimes when he commits some of his fouls. But you got to let him start working through that at some point, and no better time than the present. Because, sometime in the future, you hope this team is going to be good, and playing for something. Realistically, if they were under Miller this whole year, they would be playing for something right now. They'd be playing for a playoff spot if his winning percentage would have translated over the course of the whole season. They'd be playing for a playoff spot right now. Like, this team, I don't think is quite as far away from being at least, a 8-9-10 seed as we think. But if they want to eventually be better than that, you got to start, playing these kids and getting them good minutes, which, spoiler alert, that's going to come up a lot over these two podcasts, about where the priority should lie going down the stretch. But Mitch is a huge part of that. And I definitely agree that he should be playing 30 minutes a night. I'm just going to lump my thing in with it too, if you don't mind real quick, because our 2 points were pretty similar that we made here, even if they weren't the same. But have the same general thing. None of our other points are this close that we'll do this. But I'll say my first thing was, I think the Knicks need to let Mitch shoot some jumpers. And that's going to be part of developing him too, I think. As you said, and I cited a different stat, Macri's newsletter, he said, leads the league in effective field goal percentage, which is true, at 73%. But that's also just his regular field goal percentage, because he hasn't taken a single three-pointer all year, and that weighs three-pointers as more valuable than two-pointers. So that makes it even more impressive that he's leading the league in e-field goal percentage without even taking a three-pointer. Rudy Gobert is second in the league in just regular field goal percentage at 68.9% for the year. And so, Howard Megdal and Knicks SI, he put out a video that showed, Mitch is basically shooting jumpers before every single game. He, at minimum, does a drill where he starts somewhat close to the hoop, maybe 8 feet on the baseline, and starts shooting jumpers and just keeps moving back and back and back, like inch by inch, until he reaches the 3-point line. And, that's part of his pregame ritual at this point. So he's definitely practicing it. I think you and I have talked about this before, and Mitch doesn't need to learn to shoot, but he'll still be a great NBA player no matter what, I think, whether he ever learns how to shoot or not. But I do think that in recent weeks, and maybe you could even say the last month and change, teams have been kind of crowding him in the paint and making like an extra point to make sure that he can't get his lobs that, you know, are such a trademark for him. And like, this is kind of a silly stat, but I just felt like pulling it up anyway. So Mitch is currently 200 of 274 for the season on attempts. So he's attempted 274 shots, made 200 of them. So he could miss 16 more shots and he would still be ahead of Gobert in field goal percentage, right? If he missed 16 shots in a row. So I think since there's 27 games left, I think Mitch, like the Knicks should strive to get Mitch 1 3 or one jumper attempt, like every two games. And I don't think that's asking too much. And then even if he misses those, he's still probably going to finish the same or higher to Rudy Gobert in field goal percentage. But I think it's just important to see what Mitch has. My big comparison point would be, I would say that Miles Turner, you know, he came into the league kind of thinking he could shoot the three, but couldn't really. And he took a very low volume of attempts. Like he took like not even half an attempt per game, I think, his rookie year, shot like 20% or something like that. He added it to his repertoire in his second year. And I think that it really changed his outlook as a player. And I think that Mitch is way better of a vertical threat and way better of a defensive anchor, if we're being completely honest. I think Miles Turner is okay, but I don't think he's anything like Mitch as far as those two things. But he does have the three-point shooting touch, and he has good shot-blocking ability, but I don't think that he can affect the game quite at the level that Mitch can, or especially at the level that Mitch could if he adds a jumper. So if you look at Miles Turner, that's sort of like a baseline, I think, for what you could potentially be looking at with Mitch, but much better. Then, like, my other thing, too, I guess my last thing would just be, in addition to having him shoot some jumpers, I think they should give Mitch a chance to create off the bounce as well. Just every once in a while. Like, there was one possession earlier this year that...
I know what you're talking about already.
Yeah, there's one possession. I don't even remember who he took off the bounce, but there was one possession where Mitch got the ball at about the three-point line and just decided to put it on the floor. And it was really weird. Like, I'd never seen him do it before. But, I mean, he had to take all of about two and a half steps from the three-point line to the hoop and just blitzed past his defender and went in and dunked it or laid it up or something. I forget how the finish was, but I just remember the move. And I was like, if he could do this, that's amazing. Like, why would we not do that more often? Just catch guys off guard, because 90% of the time when Mitch gets the ball at the three-point line, he just waits there for someone to come by and then swings it to the left, swings it to the right, hands it off to somebody, whatever. So give him a chance to try some stuff off the bounce too. Like, I really do think that we have a potential special talent on both sides of the ball in Mitch. And I think it's just time at this point to unleash him and let him see if he can refine some of this stuff that he's apparently been working on before games, that he worked on all summer offensively, and let him see if he can do some of this stuff and have some fun with it. There's really no better time than right now, because, you know, the Knicks are pretty far out of the playoff race, and, you know, I'll get more into that on the next show actually, but I don't think there's any better time than the present to start giving Mitch free rein to try what he wants to do.
Well, I guess this is like this little variation off of both of our points, but I would love to see Mitch in some lineups with four shooters on the floor. And I know that's easier said than done, because it's hard to get a configuration where the Knicks have a ball handler who's also a shooter. And maybe that means Kadeem Allen honestly might be the only guy who fits that build, depending on your take on RJ's gravity and his ability to draw guys out of the paint. But some combination of like a lineup with Kadeem Allen, either Wayne Ellington or Dotson in there, Reggie Bullock, and I mean, dare I say, even someone like Bobby Portis in at power forward, or if you want to go smaller, and I guess this leads into my next point, Iggy Brazdeikis in at power forward. I hope whatever direction the Knicks go this offseason, they make it a lot more tenable to consistently have four shooters around Mitch, because as good as he's been and as efficient as he's been, that's ultimately what's going to really unlock him at a high level, giving him optimal spacing when rolling to the basket and not allowing other guys to bump him, allowing him to rebound in one-on-one situations where there aren't multiple dudes boxing him out. And to your point about letting him do some work off the dribble, I mean, that I think the reason it's such a rarity right now is because with Julius Randle out there and with, frankly, a lot of non-shooters, whether it's the point guard spot or with RJ on the wing, it's so easy for other teams to clog the lane. And when you're just sort of developing that part of your game, it's hard to be confident driving to the rim when you know that there's a second dude that can just swipe at the ball and take it away from you, even if you beat your initial guy off the dribble. But with four shooters out there and a genuine chance to go one-on-one, I think it gets a lot more interesting. Maybe I think the Knicks have one game left against the Rockets. That might be the game to do it with them playing small ball. It could give the Knicks a chance to do the same around someone like Mitchell Robinson. But anyways, that was sort of leading into my next point. I would love if the Knicks would play Iggy Brazdeikis, who has been killing it of late in the G League. These stats are from I think it's Arden Franklin of Posting and Toasting fame. Alex, mm-hmm. you know him better than I would. But he wrote a great article on what Iggy's been doing of late. Since the start of January, 25 points per game, shooting 53% from the field and 37% from three. And even beyond the scoring, which is obviously incredibly impressive, I mean, he's been really diversifying his game. He's had three different games since January 11th with at least 12 rebounds. And in three different games, 5, 7, and 8 assists. So not on a night-to-night basis, but I love the idea of Iggy like really trying to test the bounds of his abilities, because that's the whole point of the G League, to experiment with stuff and try stuff that you would never even consider trying in the NBA, which is my whole argument for Dennis Smith Jr. going down there, which obviously doesn't seem like it's ever going to happen. But I think Iggy's built up enough confidence that I really want to see what he can do at an NBA level. And it's not worth it if he's going to come in for 2-3 minutes in a blowout once every 4 or 5 games. But if Mike Miller was actually willing to commit to playing him even 18 minutes a night, I think that's worth doing. And just from a personal sort of selfish perspective, I kind of want to see what the guy can do. I have a feeling that if he was a first round pick with the same exact talent, we would have already seen a lot more of him. So I'm hoping that's something that happens into the second half of the season. And honestly, I feel like he's someone who can genuinely help the Knicks with some size at the wing spot, but also an ability to shoot that frankly, they don't really have there, at least in terms of someone with as diverse of an offensive game as he brings to the table.
Yeah, and you know, to your point, like, he seems to be kind of underrated as a playmaker, maybe. You can only read so much into G League stuff, but, you know, I think he's a pretty decent passer. He keeps his head up a lot when he's driving. I think we saw that, you know, even during some of his garbage time minutes. I just remember one moment, if I'm not mistaken, where he was driving in and he made, you know, he kind of has that rumbling, bumbling, stumbling like way about him when he's getting into the lane, where he's almost like Knox in a way, you know, like where Knox just kind of looks like he's all limbs and is totally out of control. But the difference is that Iggy like actually is in control and can make some plays out of it sometimes. And I remember one where he was driving in and made a pretty nice pass. I forget to who, but for a three. And that kind of stuck with me of being like, oh, maybe Iggy has something even more to offer than we thought. But like, yeah, I'm with you, man. I absolutely want to bring him up. And I want to play him some. And, you know, I don't know. It's tough for me to exactly point out where I want the minutes to come from, because there's a part of me that wants to send Knox down to the G League for like 5 games, if he'd be willing to do it, and then bring him immediately back up and, you know, see if he can kind of figure himself out too. But that would give a good opportunity to play Iggy those minutes like right away, and let him get his feet wet in real NBA minutes and maybe see if he's ready for the show kind of, because I think there's a real chance he is. The only thing that sort of worries me a little bit is his defense, but no matter what, I think he plays very hard defense, you know, whether or not he can always keep his guy in front of him or something against maybe some of the more elite wing talents in the NBA. I think he's always going to give guys a good fight on the perimeter. He just seems to never stop moving, you know, in the limited minutes that we have gotten to see him. And we've now seen, you know, in various spurts, not so much in the NBA because he hasn't really had any playing time opportunity so far, but we saw in Summer League And we've seen with Westchester now that he can really get hot and he can hit the three at a high rate and do all the type of stuff that you really like to see. So I'm totally with you, man. I very much support this proposition. I'd love to bring Yiggy up and treat this, you know, part of this, you know, quote unquote second half of the season as, you know, a tryout for him in a very youth forward time, which, again, I don't want to spoil too much because that's one of my points for the next episode. But yeah, I'm definitely into it.
Yeah. And just, I mean, before we wrap up, I mean, to your point on whose minutes he would take, I don't think outside of RJ, there's anyone is untouchable on the wing rotation. Like any of these guys, you want to take them out, give them less minutes. I mean, I'm all for totally taking Bobby Portis out of the rotation outside of some, I guess, shooting specific lineups around Mitch. But even with that, I'd rather go small and play. I know there are certain power forwards that Iggy just can't come close to matching up with at this point, but I wouldn't mind him playing some minutes at the four. And I honestly think what he would give the Knicks with a genuine shooting threat at that spot would kind of make up for what he would take away defensively. And again, I'm probably coming from a little bit of a place of ignorance and underestimating how bad of a defender he is at an NBA level just right now, just because he's a rookie. And I mean, most rookies can't compete in the NBA at that level, particularly ones without elite athletic ability. But I don't really care if they have to bench, whether it's Ellington, Bullock. I kind of want him to play. With that, I think we can just about wrap up this part one and come back with part two. Two more resolutions from Alex, one more from me. So we'll have that for you tomorrow on Locked On Knicks.